That meant walking past Jabe and Mount Feed. The boy was as sad as Orin had ever seen him.
I'm never going to get back on the range with you guys.
Jabe looked up at Orin forlornly.
You might be able to help us out in other ways,
Orin said, and give her a week. She'll have forgotten all about the other day.
She should have kept Tar around,
Jabe said. Annalene's voice sounded from over the shelves in the next aisle. Tar wouldn't have stayed and you know it. You're family. This is a family business. Orin smirked.
Better learn now, boy.
Woman knows all, hears all. But he happened to agree. Tar Lup was a hairy-faced Shistavanan that Danar had brought in to clerk when Annalene's pregnancy with Jabe turned difficult. Amiable and ambitious, Tar had left for big city retail, where he was doing well. Orin had prevailed upon him to return to help out for a few months after Danar's death, which he did gladly. You could take someone out of the oasis, Orin liked to say, but that sense of community was always there. But Tar wasn't likely to come back as a stalker, and they all knew it. Jabe shook his head sadly and returned to his chore. Walking back to the garage, Orin found his children huddled over the back of a repulsor truck, poring over the goods inside. That's the stuff?
Yep,
Mullen said, moving aside to let Orin approach.
It's the last batch of Tuscan junk from the Bizarre Raid.
Orin looked into the back of the vehicle. A couple of bandoliers, another gaffy stick, some putrid-smelling pouches. The Tuscans never had anything they didn't steal from someone else. But it was interesting to try to see the world through their eyes.
No clothes?
Mullen snorted.
You want to strip those stinking things down?
Not hardly. It was an experience you didn't repeat. Whatever the Tuscans were born as, a lifetime in the suns, under wraps, turned them into something frightful. They smelled frightful anyway. Pulling a spanner from the folds of his cloak, he used it to gently lift a pair of goggles. Tuscan eyewear was strange. Some wore normal goggles, sheathed in wrapping. Others wore independent eyepieces, tightly rooted in their masks, but all terminated in the same nonsensical turrets. Whatever shielding the dull metal tubes provided to Tuscan eyes against the suns couldn't have been worth the peripheral vision they took away. And if there was a way to use the lens inside to see farther, he hadn't figured it out.
Not much here, Warren said.
Well, you know what to...
Got it,
Mullen said, wrapping the bundle up. Orin backed away from the repulsor truck and right into another of Glomer's aides. The female mechanic, this one a proper human, not much older than Jabe, grew red-faced.
I'm so sorry, Master Galt.
Orin dusted himself off.
It's all right, he said. Busy Trump standing around in my world.
It's an emergency,
the dark-haired girl said. She reached for a jug of blue liquid on a shelving unit.
It's old Ulbrich. His engine overheated again on the way here from his place.
Orin knew Ulbrich well. The cheap character probably bought coolant by the spoonful. He's just sitting out there in the dunes.
Of course,
the girl said. Looking around, she lowered her voice.
He's afraid someone will steal his vehicle if he leaves. It's no problem. Happens all the time. Today it's my turn to go out.
Orin calculated for a moment. He reached out and stopped the aide. Look, I'm heading out anyway. I'll take care of him. He reached for the jug of coolant. It's the least I can do for the work you've done for me.
That's wonderful, sir. I'll let Glomer know.
The girl dashed off, leaving the Galts alone. Mullen looked to his father.
You figuring on trying to sell Ulbrich on joining the call again?
I'm the king of lost causes, Orin said, snorting, as well as the Jundland. He laughed.
Besides, who knows? Maybe saving the old man will put us over the top.
Or maybe I'll give Callie Calwell's hero a run for his money.
I wish,
Mullen said, glaring in the direction of the door to the store.
I'm sick of hearing that little idiot babble about the heroic drifter.
Vika chortled.
Give the girl a break. He's the first male she's seen outside of a dewback pen.
Orin found his land speeder and settled into the driver's seat. Be nice. Bored people imagine things, he said. But if any bronze gods 3 meters tall come riding up, page me on the comlink. That I'll want to see.
The red comlink by the till went off. It was Annalene's dedicated connection to Orin. Communications were always iffy on Tatooine, but Orin still did his best to stay in touch. She picked it up.
You can't have run out of customers already.
That's not it.
Orin's crackling voice replied.
Saw something on my way out. You're about to have a visitor.
Annalene inhaled for a moment.
No, not that visitor.
Orin said, somehow reading her silence correctly.
Someone else.
Annalene listened as he explained.
Right, she said, clicking the comlink off. Callie, Jabe, come on!
Her daughter looked over to see Annalene picking up the blaster rifle from behind the counter. Jabe, suddenly aware, dropped his broom.
Do you need to activate the settler's call?
No, she said, passing him another rifle. This is a Calwell call. Get your gun, Callie.
We're about to have company.
Chapter 8.
The Sandcrawler had started its journey in the south, far beyond the Great Pass. There, the Jundland High Country separated to allow entry into the western Dune Sea, for anyone daft enough to go there. The land between the pass and the oasis was almost featureless, making it easy to spot the metal behemoth rumbling toward the store. Still, Annalene was thankful for Orin's early warning. The machines made decent time for their size, and the alert had given her time to lock away the cache. By the time the rolling rummage sale trundled to a stop in the south yard, Annalene and her children were there waiting for it. Wearing her gray-brimmed safari hat, Annalene stood in the sandcrawler's shadows. The suns blazed high over the angled nose of the vehicle. If there was anyone up in the control cabin, she couldn't see them. It didn't matter. There was something she had to do now, something she'd done for 20 years of prior impromptu visits by the Jawas. Something she'd seen Danar do during her first year clerking. A thing that told her then that he wasn't just another grubber who'd go broke in a year.
Let's do this,
Annalene said, snapping the power cartridge into her rifle.
Aw, Annie,
Lily said. She and the other customers had emerged when they heard the sandcrawler approach.
You're not gonna shoot him.
Annalene said nothing, instead leading her children to the side of the vehicle. Foul steam emanated from the behemoth's overheating engines.
You know the drill, she said.
Jabe and Callie nodded, even as the mighty ramp began to creak open. The ramp end hit the ground with a muted clang. The Calwells raised their weapons and turned them on their crowd of customers.
Now hear this, Annalene said. This land is my property. If there's any trading to be done with the Jawas, I'm going to do it. If you don't want to pay my markup, you get on your dewback and head on up to the Mosspick Range or wherever they're going next.
A low, agitated rumble came from the crowd. Annalene responded by firing once into the air.
I'm serious, she growled.
She glared at the gathering. Any one of you tries to buy a rivet from these guys, know this. I'm not going to shoot the Jawas. Selling's what they do. They're never going to comprehend property lines. You, on the other hand, know very well where you are and what the rules are.
so you might as well go back inside.
If there's anything worth having, we'll put it on sale after we've wiped it down. Her point was made. Grumbling patrons of the claim started to wander back into the building. Annalene hadn't had to shoot anyone in a long time. One stun blast every few years was usually enough to convince people that this was her commercial terrain. She would let Glomer come out from the garages and deal directly. In slower years, he'd supplemented his business by buying defunct equipment from the Jawas and refurbishing it. But the store already took a percentage on his trades, so that was in the family. A tiny figure in a brown cloak and hood appeared on the ramp. Half her height, the Jawa's glowing eyes met hers. He gave a wave. She nodded back. "Keep an eye on them," she told her children, still on guard. "Make sure they don't steal anything." Callie laughed.
"Who? The Jawas or our customers?"
"Both. Callie, you watch the Jawas. Jade, you get back inside and mind the place before they start drinking straight from the taps." Jade moaned.
"I've been in there all day."
"Fine, then you stay out here and Callie goes inside." Callie gave her mother an anguished look.
"That's not fair either. My job is outside, remember?"
Annalene looked coyly at the young woman. "Ah, yes, that was you outside earlier, telling all my diners about how Ben saved you from killing yourself." She struck her forehead with her palm in mock surprise.
"Oh, wait. That was inside, wasn't it?
Now scoot." Callie stomped back into the claim. Jade gave a triumphant hoot and marched to where Mullen and Vika were standing with several of the other Galt farmhands, bemused by the whole scene. Annalene watched Jade join them inside. Her kids were 16 and 17. Would they ever be done competing with each other? Whichever child won each battle, the prize was always one more headache for her. And she wasn't any happier with Jabe's choice in friends. Mullen Galt had been a grump of a kid and hadn't improved, and Vika had been a mess ever since her twin brother died. Annalene wouldn't let Callie near the older girl. She wasn't having the same luck keeping Jabe away. Someone tugged at her sleeve from behind. Annalene thought for a second it might be a Jawa. Instead, she turned to see Herbalee Napti standing there.
"Do you work here, young person? There was no one inside at the counter."
Annalene sighed aloud. Slinging the rifle over her shoulder, she grasped the Nikto woman gently by the shoulders and turned her to face the Lee Jawa.
"Here, ma'am, you have my personal permission to buy from the Jawas, courtesy of Danar's claim."
The lead Jawa chirped at Annalene in puzzlement as the elderly customer approached him. Annalene shrugged. "She's for sale, if you want her," she said, darting quickly away to look at the wares coming down the ramp. It took less than 5 minutes for the Jawas to bring down everything worth owning. They were well practiced at this. Annalene surveyed the lot. Too many droids, as usual. She didn't carry them. Danar had never liked selling things he didn't know how to fix, and it was a good policy. You didn't want to guarantee a machine just to have it start a killing spree in someone's kitchen. The small appliances, however, she could put out as is. Walking down the line, she was struck by remorse, as always. Every one of these things was scavenged from the home of some prospector family in the hills that couldn't make a go of it. One cooker she recognized on sight. She'd sold it 3 times.
"Tabu, tabu! Tabu, tabu!"
Annalene's eyes darted back toward the ramp. 2 tiny Jawas were clawing quickly up it, leaving a third wailing creature behind. Vika and several of the Galt farmhands had formed a circle and were tossing the terrified Jawa as if it were a throw toy.
"Lose the Jawa, buy the drinks!"
Vika rasped, having already laughed herself hoarse. Hey! Annalene yelled. Quit that! She rushed toward the group, stopping only when she saw that Jabe was part of the circle. Annalene's eyes bulged. Jabe! Jabe looked up at the voice. It was enough distraction to cause him to drop the toss heading his way. The Jawa squealed and scampered loose, heading for the ramp. Jabe had heard his mother's voice, but the farmhands were closer, egging him on. Buy the drinks! Buy the drinks! No, you don't, Jabe said, bursting through the circle to chase the meter-tall creature. Annalene reached the foot of the ramp just as Jabe dashed up it. Jabe vanished inside the darkness of the doorway. I've got you, you little... Jabe reappeared, eyes wide and the blood drained from his face. Behind him in the doorway loomed someone else. A hooded figure all in brown, just like the Jawa who had escaped, but twice the height. Desperate to escape the giant, Jabe tripped and tumbled down the ramp, even as Vika and the other hands went for their blasters. Annalene laughed as her son landed at her feet. Blasters down, folks. It's not the giant Jawa Avenger. She smiled as her rescuer looked down at her and saluted. Hello, Ben, she said. Welcome to the claim. Ben removed his cowl. Good afternoon. Noons. He looked up and took a breath, clearly pleased to be out of the wretched air of the sandcrawler. I hope I didn't frighten anyone. The Jawas were kind enough to give us a ride in. He whistled and Rue appeared in the doorway behind him. He fished around and found her lead. I'd have stepped out earlier, but she got a bit tangled up in there. Ben's eyes turned back down the ramp to where Annalene stood over Jabe. Is the boy all right? He hasn't been right for a while, Annalene said, lifting Jabe to his feet by his collar. She glared at him. I told you to watch the Jawas, not use them for sport. Now get back over there. Jabe meekly recovered his rifle and trudged to the far side of the product display line, eager to avoid eye contact with his friends. Ben and his Eopi stepped down onto the surface. Your son? I'm ashamed to admit it, Annalene said, chuckling. He must have thought you were a giant Jawa. Ah, Ben said. Must be the eyes. Scratching Rue's neck, Ben looked up at the store building ahead of him. Nice place. For out here in the wastelands, Annalene said. I didn't say that. It's okay, she said, trying in vain to remember the last time someone worried about offending her. It should be nice. It's mine. Ben stood and walked his animal toward the building. He read the block letters carved in the sign out front. Sand had collected in some of the indentations. Danar's claim. He founded it. I came along later, Annalene said, finding a morsel in her pocket for the Eopi. It was such a docile creature. It took after its owner, she thought. Danar's my husband. Your husband, Ben repeated. His eyes scanned the crowd outside the sandcrawler. Annalene rubbed Rue's face lovingly. It's just me now, and the two kids you've already met. She smiled. What brings you here? Your invitation, he said, nodding toward the animal. I could use some feed for Rue. Annalene stood. You've come to the right place. She looked back toward the sandcrawler, where her son stood limply against the gargantuan vehicle, guarding nothing in particular. Jabe, get this man some Eopi feed, now! The boy looked up. But I thought you wanted me to watch the Jawas. Forget it, she said. The Jawas were clustered around Herbally now, occasionally chattering to each other as they listened to the elderly Nikto woman's questions. They're probably all trying to figure out how to end the conversation, Annalene thought. She looked to Ben. First bags on the house. Ben lowered his eyes. He did that a lot, she'd noticed.
Please, you don't have to give me anything. I can pay. It's for saving me the burial expenses for my daughter. Besides, one meal and Yuriope will have you back here every week. Only the best here. Just let me tie her up,
Ben said, spotting the livery yard.
I knew the feed would be a big load for her on the way back, so I asked the Jawas for a ride in.
Annalene watched him lead the animal away. Jabe stepped back from the doorway long enough to whisper to her.
Did you say Ben? Is that the guy?
Uh-huh. She repositioned her hat and exhaled. He's only a few days late.
Ben!
Jabe had entered the store less than 20 seconds before his mother and the visitor passed through the door. But it had been enough time for him to inform his sister of Ben's arrival, and for her to inform the 24 patrons in the place. Ben nodded as the girl met him at the door. He'd already placed the cowl back over his head, Annalene saw. She didn't blame him at all.
Hello, Callie, Ben said.
Hey, you remembered, Callie beamed. Welcome to our store. Let me show you around the place.
Your place is the Dewback Pens,
Annalene said. Callie pointed at her mother.
Yes, but you told me to work inside.
Come on, she said, grabbing at Ben's sleeve. What do you need? Because you know we've got it.
Yes, well, I've got a broken bridle.
Tack room!
The girl led him toward the back of the sales floor, between tables of curious diners. Annalene followed, fearful for the man's dignity. If Ben acknowledged the stares at all, she didn't notice. But she wasn't going to have a new customer scared off, particularly a customer to whom she owed a debt. Ben stood in the doorway of a tiny room, looking at the array of gear.
It was a closet, Callie said, suppressing a blush. But it's the one part of the store that's mine.
Annalene reached past them for a rack of bridles.
I thought it would give her something to do.
Ben looked back into the store, alive with shoppers and diners, drinkers and postal patrons.
You seem to do a great many things already.
Except stop raging dewbacks. Annalene passed a bridle to Callie and pointed her outside.
Get that fitted up for him.
Miffed at having been dismissed, the girl smiled at Ben and dashed for the exit.
I'll be back.
She'll be back, Ben said dryly.
Annalene led Ben back through the dining area, an obstacle course of diners with questions about his earlier rescue.
Who was he? Where was he from?
Didn't he know no one with good sense went out onto the rumbles? Where did he live? And would he like to know how to adjust his vaporator? Would he like to buy a land speeder so he didn't have to hitchhike with Jawas? Had he come from off-world? And if so, what was really going on with the Republic? Seeing the man blanch a little at the barrage, Annalene hustled him toward the front of the store.
Press conference after he's done shopping. Sure, sure.
Lily stood, arms crossed, surveying Ben as only a lusty Zeltron could.
Keep the new arrival to yourself.
Annalene turned her head and whispered,
You have a husband and 5 kids. And a pulse,
Lily said, a hand on her own red-skinned wrist. She smiled.
Bring him back soon.
The newcomer's head sank a little lower. Annalene looked up the aisle, alarmed. More patrons were looking at them. And now the Galts were inside, studying the new arrival. She had to do something.
Excuse me,
she said, leaving Ben by a rack of shirts. She walked to her counter and hopped up on it. Standing, she cupped her hands together and shouted in her best last call voice,
Now hear this! This is a one-time-only event. The Jawa embargo is off. Shop!
It took a moment for the words to register, and then bedlam. Ben stood back, startled, as a flood of customers rushed for the exit. Some at the bar remained, but all the gawkers left. Ben looked up, obvious thanks on his face.
A special occasion, I take it. I always said the Jawas might be good for something someday, she said. You never know what role someone will play, he murmured.
He watched her thoughtfully as he helped her down off the counter. Chapter 9. The metal tub was full. Overfull, in fact. Anna Lean had taken advantage of the calm to walk Ben through every aisle of the store, helping him find the items on his list, and many things that weren't. She'd even pointed out which cheaper imported products were just as good as the more expensive local ones. Had any of her regulars overheard her, she'd have been mortified. Nobody got this kind of service. And he'd responded to it, Annalene thought. The store is a living thing to you, he had remarked. A strange observation, to be sure, almost poetic coming from a what? She didn't know. Ben hadn't told her anything substantive about himself. Where are you from, Ben?
All about, really. Why are you here?
On Tatooine or here at the store?
What do you do?
This and that, nothing important. That last answer described 2/3 of her patrons. She'd gotten more substance out of some of her discussions with Bomer, the Rodian who spoke no basic. But while Ben's non-answers were frustrating, they neither surprised nor offended her. None of her customers told her much on the first visit. Not verbally, anyway. What they bought, however, spoke volumes. And Ben's tub, a portable wash basin now doubling as a shopping basket, brimmed with clues for the retail eye. The curtain rod told her he wasn't camping. The basic tools told her he hadn't been there long. The tins of food paste told her he intended to stay for a while, and that he lived too far away to shop often. The containers of industrial-strength solvent told her he had a big cleaning job ahead. And rags. Who bought rags? Someone who traveled light, who'd arrived without old clothing to spare for cleaning. Finally, there was that other little tidbit, which she had very nearly overlooked. A bed pillow. Just one. She casually strolled the aisles, finding out a little more from him in between Callie's periodic interruptions to report her progress. When the supply room failed to yield packing accessories sized for Ben's EOP, the girl had taken it upon herself to invent something with spare parts. She'd lashed 2 smaller feed sacks to a 3rd to create a saddle pannier, and had spent the last half hour working on increasing the load. Only twice did Annalene and Ben hear the surprised bleat of a tipped-over animal from outside. Callie means well, Annalene had said. Ben hadn't seemed concerned. And while he'd sounded knowledgeable about life in the desert, Annalene had grown to believe he didn't know much about Tatooine. All desert worlds were the same, except in the ways they weren't. Many an overconfident transplant had learned the hard way. A foolish Geonosian had gone broke, protecting his house here against flash floods that existed only in his home world memories. But as customers re-entered one by one, Ben grew anxious for the tour to end.
This should be sufficient, he said. Are you sure? I'm not trying to upsell you. I'm just afraid I'll need a second EOP before we're through.
Annalene chuckled. We sell those too. She placed the armload of goods she was carrying on the counter, while Ben set the metal tub on the sinstone floor.
All right. One cashier, no waiting.
He shuffled on his feet and reached in his pocket.
Are Republic credits still good here? As good as they ever were, she said, stepping behind the counter. We don't pay politics much mind. Let me deal with the loose things first, and then we'll get to what's in the tub. She began adding the items to his already lengthy sales tab, and as she did, she could see him counting along, keeping a running tally to himself. It wasn't the nervous watchfulness of her more strapped customers, but he was still keeping track. So he can afford all this, she thought, but money still matters.
Look there, a gruff voice said. Someone's done some shopping.
Annalene looked toward the exit to see Mullen standing in the doorway with his sister Vika. Behind them loomed Zed, one of their Jawa-tossing accomplices. Zed was human but only just, muscle-bound and currently black-eyed. She had heard that a social misstep involving a Wookiee in Anchorhead had caused the latter condition, as well as the departure of several of Zed's teeth. It was Zed's incapacitation that had given Jabe his chance to fill in on the lead Galt service crew. Annalene was happy to see Zed return to work. But she wasn't happy to see him here now. Mullen's bad attitude only grew more toxic when he had his pet Mountain shadowing him. The door slammed shut behind the trio, who started walking purposefully toward the counter.
Surprised you're buying here, instead of from your little friends, Mullen said, approaching Ben from behind. Decent people don't take rides from Jawas.
It won't replace shuttle service, that's true, Ben said.
He didn't look up from folding and sorting his cloth goods on the counter. Annalene paused her own counting.
Be nice, Mullen.
That's right. Remember, he's the big hero.
Vika strutted up to the counter beside Ben. She hoisted herself onto it, nearly knocking his neat stack of cloth goods onto the floor.
Get off there!
Annalene said, shoving at the young woman. Vika didn't budge. Ben slipped his folded purchases inside his new pillowcase.
It's all right, he said quietly. It's just high spirits.
Spirits is right, Annalene said, sniffing at Vika.
And not even an hour past lunchtime. Well done.
She wished again that Danar had never decided to keep the bar open all day long. A look at Mullen and Zed said they were similarly lubricated.
Don't you people have vaporators to get back to?
Mullen belched.
Our machines, our schedule.
I don't think your father would agree with you, Annalene said. Mullen knelt by the wash basin at Ben's feet.
That's a lot of junk he's buying. Is his money good?
Mullen grabbed the handle of the tub with one hand and slid it closer. If Ben took offense or even noticed as the dark-haired man pawed through his purchases, Annalene didn't see.
I wouldn't trust him, Mullen finally pronounced.
Annalene slammed her data pad on the counter.
That's enough, all of you.
Last I checked, Mullen Galt, your name wasn't on the deed.
Or anything else.
Except maybe that arrest warrant in Mos Entha.
Why don't you go back there?
She said. Vika sidled closer to Ben, reached out and put her thumb underneath his chin.
He's a nice one,
she said, tilting his face upward like livestock under study. Looks hungry, though.
Another grubber starving on the range.
Mullen looked up from where he crouched, to Ben's left.
He wasn't saving Callie. He probably wanted the dewback for a meal.
Behind, Zed guffawed. Vika gripped Ben's hairy chin between her thumb and forefinger.
I don't know. I'd be fine with him saving me.
She lifted his face toward hers and leered at him.
How about it, Benny? You want to save a grown-up for a change?
Fine, Ben said politely.
Do tell me when one comes in.
Annalene laughed loudly. At the sound of laughter at Vika's expense, Zed surged forward. Like half the Galt farmhands, the bruiser thought the boss's daughter, lit the stars in the sky. With Mullen still at Ben's feet with the tub, Zed grabbed at the shopper's shoulder in righteous indignation. That was when it began. Callie entered through from the livery yard to the right of the group. She carried the Bantha prod from the Jabe incident, the latest in a series of items she was returning to the tack room in her ongoing effort to see Ben. She saw her dashing hero all right, standing uneasily with Vika perched lasciviously on the counter with a leg on either side of him. Stunned, infuriated, and long possessed of the view that the wrong Galt twin had died years earlier, Callie raised the Bantha prod. Seeing the hate in Callie's eyes, Annalene hurriedly grabbed Vika's collar. As her mother attempted to pull the young woman back from danger, Callie snapped the prod in the direction of Vika's dangling right foot. The next second passed quickly. Annalene saw Ben turn to avoid the prod, raising his right hand ever so slightly. It was at that moment that the prod, which had a patented never-slip grip, flew from Callie's hand. Its electrified tip glanced harmlessly against the counter, missing Vika's boot, and somehow, also, Ben's torso. He turned 90 degrees as the implement fell past his knees to where it finally came to rest, planted vertically into the metal tub that held the rest of Ben's shopping. A metal tub still being held by the hand of Mullen Galt. With a crackling discharge, the device expended its entire energy supply in one tumultuous flash. Mullen screeched louder than the settler's call siren had ever sounded. Startled, Vika fell backward into Annalene. The sudden weight of Vika knocked her feet out from under her, and the two landed in a tangle on the floor behind the counter. Annalene scrambled to extricate herself and rise. The first thing she saw across the counter was Zed, looking stupidly down at Mullen, writhing in agony on the floor. Snarling, Zed charged Ben. The older, smaller man stepped lithely out of the way, sending the lumbering Zed into a display of cans of whitewash. The collision wasn't as loud as Mullen's scream, but it was quite a bit messier. Without a word, Ben turned, bowed slightly to Annalene and Callie, the only other still standing, and slapped a pile of credits on the counter. He grabbed the loaded pillowcase and fled through the door to the livery yard. Bewildered, Annalene hopped onto the counter and jumped to the other side, her boots just missing the writhing, weeping Mullen. Ben's tub of purchases was still there, abandoned. She ran to the doorway, where Callie was calling out after him. But more chaos waited outside. Mullen's electric screech seconds earlier had evidently placed the Jawas under the impression that a Logra, a burrowing predator with a taste for the short merchants, had surfaced inside the store. Now they were ending all transactions and moving their goods back into the sandcrawler to the frantic yells of dissatisfied customers. Two unrelated brawls had broken out. And beyond, past the revving sandcrawler, Ben and Rue rode off toward the desert. Flummoxed, Annalene started to follow to alert him to his forgotten goods. But Herbalee Napti confronted her in the doorway first.
"The little glow-eyed man told me to come talk to you," the Nikto woman said. "Do you work here?"
Chapter 10. Oren sputtered at the comlink.
"I told you not to call me with this garbage."
He tilted his head back toward his landspeeder, trying to make the glance casual. The old man hadn't overheard him. While Ulbrich was still inside the USV-5, enjoying the blast of the air conditioning, Oren doubted that the old skinflint enjoyed anything except counting his money, but that wasn't important. He hadn't come to the farmer's rescue out of friendship or even benevolence. This was a sales call. and Vika had just interrupted it with a strange, disconnected story of chaos in the claim, damage to the store and his son, and some nonsense about Callie's hero. "I don't care who did what," he said into the device, aggravated. The last thing he needed was trouble with Annalene. Once, she had barred the entire Galt employee base from dining at the claim. After a week of lunchbox living, Orin had a mutiny on his hands. There was only one response. "You'll clean up the store, apologize to Annie, and then get out here and finish your shift." He deactivated the comlink. Standing in the suns, Orin looked back at the old man in the land speeder and smiled weakly. Ulbrich still wasn't paying him any mind. The old man had more hair in his face than his head, and yes, Ulbrich was using Orin's comb to straighten his beard. Lovely, Orin thought, closing the bonnet on Ulbrich's stalled repulsor truck. The battered ST-101 would be able to make it to the claim using the coolant Orin had brought. Now he had to make the favor pay off. "You're ready, Master Ulbrich," Orin said, opening the passenger side door to his landspeeder. "Sorry about the delay. I had to take a call." The old man grunted. Orin gave a rumpled smile. "It was just trouble at home. Do you, plan on having children a while?" "I'm 75. "Take my advice," Orin said, grimacing. "Don't. It's safer that way." He offered his hand to help Ulbrich stand up, but the old man ignored it. Ulbrich was still in good shape for his age. He had recently sworn off liquor, after some event Orin knew little about. But Orin attributed Ulbrich's condition more to his having delegated most of the work on his sprawling ranch to an army of farmhands in recent years, instead of toiling in the hot suns himself. Spreading to the south and east of Orin's holdings, Ulbrich's property was more than twice the size, and Orin doubted the man had visited a single one of his vaporators in a decade. It hadn't hurt their production at all. Ulbrich was rolling in wealth he never spent. All the more reason to protect it. "Speaking of safety," Orin said, conscious of the awkward transition, "I was wondering if you'd thought about joining the settlers' call fund."
"Here we go again," Ulbrich said, derision evident in his gravelly voice. "Knew that coolant wasn't free."
He threw Orin's comb back inside the landspeeder. "I'm not trying to sell you anything. The fund helps the community protect people. Farmers, just like you."
"I got my own security."
Ulbrich tromped across the sand toward his vehicle.
"I don't need to be paying for your people to sit around getting soused."
"They're not mine," Orin said. "The fund belongs to the whole Oasis community. I just administer it." He closed the passenger door to his land speeder and followed Ulbrich. "Look, you run a business and you expect results. So do I. I respect that. If you want results, just look at the other day and what happened at the Bazaar place.
I saw you didn't save half of them."
Orin stepped back. "That's not fair, Wile. Those people died before the call was activated. But the farmer and his wife and child, though, we saved those people." He tried a different tack. "Look, yours is the largest spread around here, not part of the fund. If you came in, we'd be able to upgrade our equipment. Maybe even put out some patrols to cover your place as well as some others. Proactive-like." The old farmer stopped at the open door to his repulsor truck and turned his head. Orin stepped forward, expectantly, only to see the old man spit on the sand.
"Not interested in anywhere else," Ulbrich said. "My people watch my place. If Plug Eye comes around, you'll see a Tuscan dance."
Ulbrich climbed up into the cab of the tall vehicle. As he started the engines, he looked down at Orin, almost as an afterthought.
Thanks for the coolant. Horan shook his head. Some people you just couldn't help. The repulsor truck gone, Orin kicked the empty coolant container across the sand. He'd made most reluctant farmers come around one way or another. Not Ulbrich. The old man knew the fund based its fee on the amount of land to be protected. Ulbrich balked at paying more than anyone else on pure principle. Well, he'll figure it out. One day, Orin thought. There were more potential members to sign up. He'd need to check his map. He opened the door to his land speeder, its engine still running as it pumped out frigid air. He slipped into the driver's seat, only to find the oily comb underneath his backside. Blanching, Warren chucked it out the window and saw the pair of figures topping a dune to the northeast approaching him. Finding his electro-binoculars, Warren studied the sight. "Well, what do you know?" he said aloud. "One chance lost, another found." He put the hovercraft into motion. The USV-5 coasted to a stop just short of the new arrivals. As caravans went, Orin thought it pretty meager. A hooded man walking alongside a heavily laden Eopi. Neither reacted as Orin triggered the landspeeder's open-topped mode. Orin smiled. "Hello there." "Greetings." "That's a big load you've got." The sandy-haired nomad eyed him warily. "It's mine, if that's what you're wondering. I've come from the store." Orin chuckled.
"Oh, I know. You don't have the wardrobe for a Tuscan."
The farmer deactivated the engine and climbed out. "I'm Orin Galt. This is my land here."
"My apologies," the traveler said, looking back at the horizon. "Is it possible to get to the Calwell store without crossing the Galt land?"
"Not really, no." Orin grinned. He offered his hand.
"I think I know who you are. You're that Ben I've heard so much about."
Ben took Orin's hand and shook it tentatively.
"Heard about me?"
"From Cali Calwell. The Calwells and the Galts. We're close. And I owe you a debt of thanks. Sounds like you saved her from herself." Ben lowered his eyes.
"I think Cali embellished some. I was passing through and lent a hand. Anyone else would do the same."
Orin liked the sound of that.
"Quite right.
But still, let me get you a drink." He turned back to the landspeeder.
"We're a ways from a cantina,"
Ben said, puzzled.
"But not from the canteen."
Orin produced a gleaming silver flask and offered it to Ben.
"Enjoy."
Ben nodded and opened the vial. He drank and did an immediate double take. Gasping, he mouthed, "Wow."
"And that's lukewarm,"
Orin said, smiling broadly. He slapped the windshield of the landspeeder.
"I know you're on your way somewhere, Ben, but the least I can do is show you around. For a new neighbor."
Ben looked up, cautious.
"How do you know I'm a neighbor?"
Orin laughed. Something about wearing hoods made half the newcomers on Tatooine think they were on a secret mission.
"I doubt you're making supply runs for the Jawas. They went the other direction anyway."
He gestured toward the landspeeder.
"Come on, just for a few minutes. You trespass, you get the guided tour. You might say it's the penalty."
Chapter 11. The USV-5 rocketed across the dunes. Hill after hill bristled with shining new vaporators, metal stalagmites stabbing into the sky. Ben sat quietly in the passenger seat, taking it in. He'd resisted the tour at first, but Orin had brought out an emergency canvas shelter from the landspeeder, and within moments the Eopi was inside, munching on the feed it had been carrying. Orin watched Ben out of the corner of his eye as he drove. The man seemed quiet,
and thankfully unmarked by whatever had happened at the claim. Warren felt bad about that. The Oasis regulars, his kids included, could be rough on newcomers.
I'll tell you, Warren said again, I'm sorry about whatever happened back in the claim. When my kid called, I knew in a second who was to blame. You got any little ones, Ben?
Just the EOP,
Ben said. The farmer laughed.
I'll tell you, if kids were as teachable as EOPs, this hair would still be black.
Annalene's or something, too, but you already saw that with Callie.
Energetic,
Ben allowed.
And all trouble.
Ben looked at him.
But worth it?
Don't put words in my mouth,
Warren said, feigning seriousness, before breaking out into laughter again.
No, most days I work out here with Mullen and Vika, and sometimes Jabe, Annalene's boy. You met him?
At the Sandcrawler,
Ben said simply.
Lot to keep track of, I know. Sometimes it's hard for me to tell where Annie's family stops and mine begins.
He elaborated briefly on his friendship with Danar and how Annalene had been running the shop since Danar's death. That Annalene, she's a tower of power. Ben nodded and returned to idly staring out the window. Warren smirked. If Ben were interested in Annalene, that should have registered a response. But he seemed detached, or at least respectful of Orin's territory. Which was silly, of course. Orin and Annalene had never been like that, or at least she'd never been like that with him. Orin was married when Danar hired Annalene. By the time Orin's union started going wrong, the Calwells were married themselves, with Callie on the way. Orin wondered sometimes what would have happened if Lizelle had taken off earlier. But no. The Pika Oasis wouldn't be what it was today if he and Danar had been romantic rivals. Ben broke the silence.
How did Danar Calwell die?
It was a puzzling turn, Orin thought. I'll get to that, he said, applying the brakes. We're here. The land speeder came to rest atop a hill, overlooking a wide expanse, empty but for vaporators as far as the eye could see. The men disembarked and studied the scene. Some devices were clustered together, others separated by hundreds of meters.
Pretty, isn't it?
Unusual patterns. The way they're placed, it's almost...
an art? Not far from it, Orin said. This is field number 7, but I call it the symphony. He pointed toward the nearest vaporator, halfway up the rise they were standing on. Follow me. At the device, Orin turned a key in a lock, opening a small door on the vaporator. Inside sat a vial, sealed beneath a tap. Orin removed it. You're the guest, Ben. You do the honors. Ben took the vial and examined it. Orin nodded. Go ahead, it's what you had a while ago. Ben raised it to his lips and drank thirstily. A split second later, his face showed that had been a mistake.
It's freezing.
It's this new Pretorman vaporator model. Comes off the compressors like that,
Orin said, taking the vial back. But have you ever tasted sweeter water in your life?
I'll let you know when my tongue falls out,
Ben said, shaking his head to clear it.
The vial wasn't that cold. Things aren't always what they seem.
Orin sealed the door on the vaporator and gestured to the horizon. See, Ben, it's taken me 6 years, but we finally brought Tatooine into the new era. All those towers I started with eons ago, they're gone. Rubbish for Jawas. These Pretormans are going to change this world, and the Oasis will be at the center of it. Ben squinted up at the tower.
I admit I never really understood. I thought water was the simplest thing in the universe to produce.
Maybe in the universe, Warren said, but not on Tatooine.
Lots of reasons. Fuel cells make water, but they also make heat, something we've got enough of. That's just for starters. Ben listened, interested.
And you're too remote to ship anything in.
Right, but who'd want to? Orin walked back to the top of the rise. You see, that's the secret to this dead old planet. She's hiding her water. But what she's got is the tastiest anyone's ever had.
It's so good, I could see Tatooine being a net exporter of water.
If we can just get at it.
His voice grew solemn. And I can.
He traced his hands in the air, connecting the dots that were the faraway towers.
Those little drops can run, but they can't hide.
These machines in the right place, tuned the right way, they need that sky like clay. They play the notes, and the music comes.
The symphony, Ben said respectfully.
Orin nodded. A lot of pieces have to work together at once. We're still working at it.
I'm impressed.
Ben wasn't a farmer or anything else as far as Orin had been able to learn, but he seemed to have a feel for what Orin was trying to do. Maybe, if he turned out to have a skill, he could even be a decent farmhand once Orin started hiring again. Orin returned to the landspeeder, suddenly weary. Farming, he loved. The rest of his life was just necessary. But he wasn't out today to farm. So first things first.
You asked about Danar, he said gravely. The Tuscans killed him 8 years ago. He stopped to help a rider in the desert, like you did with Callie. Tuscans killed them both.
I'm sorry, Ben said.
Well, it's been a while, Orin said.
He turned back toward the younger man. Annalene said you were riding in from the east the other day. I don't guess you've ever heard of the Lars family. Ben cleared his throat.
The Lars, you say?
Kleeg Lars. Everyone heard about it. Orin pointed to the east. Moisture Farm are over on the other side of Jawa Heights. If you're new, you wouldn't know. The Tuscans, same band that got Danar, I've always thought, kidnapped Kleeg's wife. Ben started to say something, but stopped. Orin continued. Anyway, folks over there mounted a rescue mission. A bunch of farmers that didn't know one end of a rifle from another. They didn't have experience chasing Tuscans. They didn't have the equipment. They didn't have vehicles conditioned for more than a trip to check the vaporators.
It went badly.
Son, that's the understatement of the year. 30 went out. 4 came back. Orin remembered that horrible day and the days that had followed. Several victims had been longtime acquaintances. A lot of moisture farming wisdom had died at once. 26 gone, he said. Orin went silent to let the man take it in. Ben was troubled by the story, he could tell. It helped to paint a picture for people sometimes. And the Lars experience was as close to a worst-case scenario as it got. Orin had never met Kleeg. He'd heard the poor soul was dead now. But his tale of torment almost always had an impact. Ben looked up from the ground.
And what happened next?
Funerals, mostly. Orin didn't add that he'd picked up a few tracts of land from the estates. Someone had to work them. He leaned on the hood of the floating landspeeder. Funerals and recriminations. You see, those people didn't have what we've got in the Oasis. The call. Orin quickly explained the settler's call system. Ben listened intently, noting that he'd heard the alarm echoing over the desert once before. Orin grinned, pausing to take credit for the crate dragon idea. Nothing sends a chill through their bandages like a crate yowl. He continued the sales pitch, well practiced by now. If the Lars raid had happened here, things would have gone a lot differently. A posse is a business. It's people coming together for a goal. You've got to invest and prepare. And when the call comes, he said, pointing to one of the vaporator towers, you know you've got a chance. Ben noticed the siren mounted atop the machine. He seemed impressed.
So it's a militia, then?
Nothing like that. Oh, sure, there's a militia out of Mos Eisley, 3 or 4 full-timers, all afraid of their shadows. They never range this far out. Anyone with a mind for that kind of fighting would have headed off-world and made better money at it. This thing, it's just the people. They're not in it for the money. They just want to help.
Ben nodded.
Warren coasted into his wrap-up. We respond. We rescue. And if we can't make a defense in time, it's our policy that every attack on a household rates a counterstrike. It's what the Tuscans understand, and it works.
Ben looked to the east.
How far out do you cover?
As far as our subscribers live, Oren said. He walked to the side of the vehicle. I've got a map here.
Ben walked toward the vehicle.
As far as where, what did you call them, the Loss family lived?
No, but anything's possible if we get enough people on board, Oren replied as they both climbed into the speeder. But I thought you and your Eopi were headed southwest.
Ben shook his head and studied the map.
Just curious.
The Eopi was sleeping beneath the canvas when Oren returned with Ben. Oren was sure he'd gotten Ben's interest in the settler's call, but he hadn't coaxed much information out of him. Ben had a place against the northern outcrops of the western Jundland wastes, and he'd come from somewhere else, probably the Republic. The Republic had never really paid much attention to Tatooine, and locals here usually responded in kind. Oren had heard something about a big change that had recently taken place in the Republic, but Ben seemed to know less about it than he did. Ben had asked him for news, in fact. But while Oren still didn't know what Ben did for money, he was confident that he had some. Otherwise, Annalene wouldn't have sold him all the goods the Eopi was carrying. Her gratitude seldom went that far.
So, Oren said, watching the man repack the beast. You want to sign up with the fund? You don't have to fight with the posses. Your credits pay for them to do it.
Ben finished tightening the load and looked at him.
I don't know yet. I'm still getting settled in.
Understood. But that's more reason to join. One less thing to worry about.
You'll have to let me get back to you. I'm still not sure.
Ben paused, seeming to hear something far away. Oren followed Ben's gaze to the hills, but couldn't hear anything for several seconds. Then he heard and saw the familiar whir of his daughter Selenikio's Sportster landspeeder, heading toward them from the oasis.
Good ear, Oren said. That'd be Mullen and Vika. I guess they're dried out and ready to get back to work.
Ben looked warily in that direction and turned to take the Eopi by the bit.
I'd better go. Our first meeting didn't end well.
The Eopi started to trot, and Ben jogged along with it. He passed Oren, who leaned against his land speeder, frustrated.
Now his kids decided to get back to work. Terrific. Listen, remember the offer, Oren said. The price I cited during our ride is good only while the subscription drive is on. It goes up next week.
I'll consider it, Ben said, waving behind him.
And thanks for the drink. Sure you won't? No, I must be on my way, far to go and all. All right, then. But come back around when you decide. I will.
Oren's shoulders slumped. 0 for 2 today. And 2 more troubles had arrived and were walking up to him. Vika looked her usual self for this afternoon hour. But Mullen had a frazzled appearance that gave him pause. What had his son gotten into at the claim?
Where's Zed? Oren asked.
Hurt again,
Mullen said, glaring at the figures departing to the southwest.
Was that him?
Who?
Oren looked in the same direction.
You mean the guy with no job and no past, heading into the middle of nowhere like someone with no sense? That's Ben, all right.
He glared at his daughter.
You marry a man like that, and I'll feed you to a sarlacc. Now get to work. I'm behind schedule already.
Meditation. Today was interesting. I took a chance and went to the Peak Oasis. Danar's claim, the big compound up there. They have just about everything I need, except maybe an army to free the Republic. But I didn't stay. That's part of the problem. There are too many people there, but not quite enough either. The bigger places like Mos Eisley I can lose myself in. So many travelers come in and out. This place is busy too, but the Oasis also has a lot of regulars who do nothing but watch the comings and goings all day. My arrival was, I'm ashamed to say, something of a spectacle. And, my departure too. I can't let that happen again. I also met one of the big landowners on the way out. Orrin Gault, something of a local institution. I was reluctant to talk to him too long, and I tried to say nothing of substance, but he's nice enough, and I sense that he feels better if he knows everyone who's around. Trying to hide from a man like him might not be wise. He seems to mean well. And this settler's call system of his could be the answer to my problems keeping an eye on the Lars family, if their service could be extended that far to the east. I know it would be better not to involve them. But if Anakin's mother was taken, it could happen again. I'm here to protect the child. When it comes to the Tuskens, the locals' help might come in handy. It's a threat they're familiar with. I had a brush with the Sand People years earlier when you and I brought Padme here. They're formidable warriors. If something happens such that I can't continue my watch, well, let's not think about that. But it's nice to have options. Orrin, again, he's very much a hail fellow well met. I like him. Quite the salesman, to be sure. And while he's obviously very proud of what he's built out here, he also seems a little self-conscious about it. Enough so that he tries to put on an air of humility. Even if it's just a sales ploy, I think it's a little endearing. Anakin could have used a bit of that. We were all impressed with what he could do. But he was impressed too, and not in the least thankful for it. No, not near the end. I have his lightsaber, you know. It's right here, sitting in my hands. Some nights, like this, I just sit and stare at it, wondering what I could have done to help him. I look, and I look, for answers. Then I put it away in the trunk and try to forget. It's impossible, of course. Maybe if he'd grown older, had been able to grow older, he'd have gotten some perspective. But that just wasn't to be. If only he'd listened to reason, hadn't forced me to do what I had to do, then I wouldn't be here now feeling like a... No. Good night, Qui-Gon.
Part 2. The Killing Ground. Chapter 12.
A large hovercraft left the compound heading to the east. There was a dark-haired human male driving it, not much more than a youngling. Ayark had seen this one before, and kept silent count as the vehicle made for the horizon. Once it had left, Ayark slipped back behind the dune and brought out the black rock. A smudged mark was made on the wrappings of the warrior's left arm, while another was rubbed off the tally on the right arm. Too many marks remained there, each one representing a settler present in the Oasis compound. Dozens arrived before the suns rose each morning, and the place remained in motion until well after night fell. Keeping count had tested Ayark's wits, and the total didn't even include the people who lived in the buildings. Only one of them mattered, of course. Ayark checked the stock of the blaster rifle where more counting could be found. 10 whittled notches. 10 days since the raid on the human farm had gone wrong.
10 days since the human woman had avoided death by Dubak by mystical means. The Sand people, hearing a Yogg-Tellivar, had chosen to call her Enagrash, the Air Shaper. A Yogg had not had to convince them of what her existence meant. Settlers so empowered would threaten them all. A Yogg had known one person to have such powers, another Tuscan, long since dead. That raider had come to join the Sand people willingly, an exceptionally rare thing, and had survived the welcome and trials that followed, which was almost unheard of. That warrior had the ability to shape the air too, a fact that had certainly helped during the initiation. But that recruit had ultimately proved mortal, and that gave a Yogg hope now. It meant an air shaper could die. This woman must, before she taught her skills to the other settlers. A Yogg had found the air shaper's home easily. She'd made no efforts to conceal the path of her surviving Dubak. Settlers might have found tracking difficult on the rocky ground between the pitted area and the oasis, but they were not Tuscans. A Yogg had crept up to the compound for a simple reconnaissance, only to realize the scope of the challenge. It was more than the sheer number of arrivals and departures. This place was the fortress of the Smiling One. It had to be. The war leader recognized from afar the vehicles the settlers had used in the defense of the farm. These and many more were stored in the huge garages. How large an army did the Smiling One have? A Yogg hesitated to find out. A Yogg had also seen the fuzzy-faced Eopi rider from earlier, but only once, 7 days ago, departing the compound quickly with his mount. The human's presence had been puzzling, as a Yogg had never seen him arrive. He had to have traveled with the Jawas. That fact alone was offensive. Jawas were no better than the parasites the Sand people plucked off their banthas. They were the children of the Coward Sun, to be sure. The Eopi rider even dressed like one of them in his brown robe. Perhaps Hairy Face, that seemed a good name for the man, was a shaman to the Jawas, able to command the chattering things. The watchful raider had thought to follow the man as he journeyed toward the wastes, but the air shaper had appeared in the yard, calling vainly after Hairy Face, alongside her foolish Dubak-riding child. A Yogg had realized something else that day. The air shaper also had a son. He was the one who had just driven away in the repulsor craft. The boy wasn't much older than a Yogg's own son. Young Adin was back with the others today, going through the rites of adulthood. A Yogg didn't want to be there. It would mean seeing what had become of the ritual. By tradition, the tested youth was to have hunted and killed a crate dragon, but crates were few in the pillars where the tribe hid, and so were eligible Tuscan youths. So the elders had decreed that some other creature might suffice, such as a Logra. Still dangerous, but nothing like a crate. A Yogg thought the choice was cowardly and had said so. It described a clan so weakened that it could no longer keep to its principles. If a Dean fell to a crate, fine. The child would have been adjudged a weakling and would have deserved death. It didn't matter that the boy was the last of a Yogg's children. The warrior would have taken a blade to a Dean personally, rather than see him live as a failure. But no one would know a Dean's worthiness now. They would be killing womp rats next and pretending it was bravery.